I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs together. We are in a subcommittee right now until we get a quorum. So to start off, I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 460. Mr. Shook?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 460 directs the Department of Human Services to establish a registry and advisory committee related to birth anomalies and adverse pregnancy outcomes.
Thank you, Mr. Shook. This is a bill that is extremely important to me, and I think this will be our second session to introduce it. Basically, it does establish a birth anomalies registry in Oregon, and we are only one of four states that does not have one. Basically, what the birth anomaly registry would do would be to monitor trends and clusters of birth anomalies, and to me, that's extremely important. Now that we're looking at health care reform and prevention registry, how can we prevent birth anomalies when we don't know anything about them and where they are located? And so this would be able to help us in that piece. We would be able to identify what birth anomalies are occurring in the state and where they are occurring. It will also provide a means to refer families affected by birth anomalies to needed services. It will also allow the state to initiate prevention programs related to preventable birth anomalies and then evaluate if the prevention programs are working. And it will also help in planning where and what types of services will be needed for families affected by these conditions. So with that, I would like to call up my partner in crime, Joanne Rogovoy. Richard Lowenson, both from the March of Dimes.
Starting with 460.
Yep, I realize that. Do we have a physical on there? I didn't find one in my packet. Do we have a physical on that? I didn't find one in my packet.
Not on 460.
Chair Mona Sanderson and committee members, I think that you gave most of my testimony.
Say it again. This committee needs to hear it.
My name is Joanne Rogovoy, and I'm the State Program Director for the March of Dimes, and I'm here to ask your support of Senate Bill 460. The mission of the March of Dimes is to improve the health of newborns by preventing birth anomalies, preterm birth, and infant mortality. And with Senate Bill 460, we believe that states play a vital role in preventing birth anomalies and adverse pregnancy outcomes by maintaining a monitoring system or a registry, and we often use those terms interchangeably. The registry system would collect data for detecting birth anomaly trends, and it would also provide information or suggest areas where we need to do further research. It also is a means to refer families to services when we do find a birth anomaly. Currently, as Senator Mona Sanderson said, we are one of only four states that does not have a birth anomaly registry or monitoring system. The other states are Idaho, Wyoming, and South Dakota. Every other state, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico, track birth anomalies. Approximately 1 in 33 of our babies in Oregon will be born with a significant birth anomaly, and 1 in 10 of our babies will be born preterm. Birth anomalies account for 1 in 5 infant deaths, and that makes them the leading cause of infant death. And again, birth anomaly registries serve many purposes. They provide a baseline number of birth anomalies in the state, which we currently don't have. They identify trends or clusters of birth anomalies. They identify what types of conditions are occurring in the state and where they're occurring. They identify children that need services. We can, with the birth anomaly system, refer families to appropriate services, evaluate service utilization, plan for services that will be needed for the children that have birth anomalies. We can initiate prevention programs, and we can actually evaluate prevention programs if we had a birth anomaly tracking system or a registry. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that the cost of a birth anomaly system would be about $5 to $10 per live birth. And the other 46 states that have systems in place use various mechanisms to fund those programs, and most states use a combination of funding mechanisms. I'd like to make a point that there is a lot of costs to be saved by preventing a birth anomaly. CDC reports that hospital charges due to birth anomaly conditions average about $18,500 per hospitalization, and hospitalizations on the average last 6 days for a birth anomaly condition. And about 30% of pediatric admissions are related to birth anomalies. Overall, in this country, we spend $2.6 billion on pediatric hospital admissions for conditions related to congenital anomalies. If we look at preterm birth, we know that the emotional cost of adverse pregnancy outcomes like preterm birth is very high to families, but also the financial cost is high to the state, and it's high to employer health insurance programs. Data analyzed recently for the March of Dimes illustrated this, that a healthy full-term infant, hospital charges and physician charges for the first year are about $4,500, and if we look at preterm birth, it's 11 times higher at over $49,000. Employers, health insurance pay these costs, and we also cover the cost for children that are born with birth anomalies and preterm birth and adverse pregnancy outcomes through the Oregon Health Plan. And I think it would behoove us to prevent what we can, prevent the preventable. We know that over 40% of our births are covered by the Oregon Health Plan. So in the long run, we would be saving a lot of money for the state. I'd also like to point out that if we could prevent one birth anomaly that's preventable, like fetal alcohol syndrome, we would save $2 million in lifetime costs. And if we could prevent one case of spina bifida, which is preventable, we would save between $650,000 and $1 million in preventable health care costs. With this, and on behalf of the March of Dimes, I ask your support of Senate Bill 460 to create a birth anomaly system in Oregon, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Chair Monis Anderson and committee members, I'm Richard Lowenson. I'm a perinatologist and the chair of the Health Professionals Advisory Committee of the Oregon March of Dimes. I'm here in both capacities to urge you to support Senate Bill 460, which would allow Oregon to join the rest of the United States in creating a birth anomaly registry. There are several reasons why such a registry is important to our state, and there will be some overlap in my presentation as well. Not all birth anomalies are apparent at birth, and it is important to allow for late entries. As an example, part of the definition of the fetal alcohol syndrome includes mental retardation, which can't be identified at birth. It takes some time afterwards. Many heart anomalies are not apparent for a week or more after birth. Most cerebral palsy is not obvious at birth. So by using only the information collected on birth certificates, we miss these problems. A registry which collects data through the first 6 years of life would help us find these infants and children. We've all become uncomfortably aware of how difficult it is to anticipate which things around us might be dangerous. From the paint on children's toys to the plastic of our water bottles, the risks are subtle and not always apparent for some time. Birth anomalies, unfortunately, serve as the canary in a coal mine, as an early warning of environmental problems. This can be complicated, as most anomalies are seen at low frequencies. A number of years ago, for example, we saw three pregnant mothers within a month who had infants with gastroschisis, a problem where the skin doesn't close normally over the abdomen, and the intestines grow outside of the body. All three were very young women. All three had been migrant workers. One came from Klamath Falls, one from Hood River, one from Corvallis. We were concerned that this might represent the effect of an insecticide, but we really didn't know the baseline rate for our state, and we didn't have any effective way to see if this was a significant blip in the condition, even with the help of the state health department. As all of you know, gaining support to combat any condition with money requires facts and figures to back up the request. If we don't know the true birth anomalies, it's difficult to ask for dollars to deal with them or to qualify for federal dollars to deal with them. It's also difficult to decide between competing requests when you don't know the relative magnitude and impact of the different conditions, and impossible to evaluate whether or not existing programs are effective. This bill would help with all of these issues. As a physician who's come in contact with these conditions in my work, as well as a concerned citizen of this state, I urge you to consider this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I think we'll have the parents come up, unless there are questions. Okay. Jennifer Horner and Kim Buchanan.
I have asked for 460, but I don't have it.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Jennifer Horner, and I'm from Northeast Portland. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 460 as a parent. My son Henry was born 10 years ago with several birth anomalies. The most significant was called a diaphragmatic hernia, and it is a birth defect that impedes the lungs' ability to grow in utero. And it requires immediate surgery after birth. He lived for 2 weeks in the NICU at a Portland hospital, and despite the best care and several surgeries, passed away when he was 2 weeks old. It's difficult to talk about, but I feel like it's a really important example of a family's experience. My husband and I support the bill to allow for a registry as a way of tracking birth anomalies in the state of Oregon. As a family that lost a child, we are continuing to struggle with those questions. Why did it happen? What went wrong? What caused it? You know, we may never know. Having a place to document and track these issues may allow for researchers to better understand experiences like ours and help answer these questions. It can allow for better use and access to resources. Without it, you know, how do public health and medical providers know what is needed in each community? How do we even know where to begin? You know, were we one of a few? Were we one of, you know, one in a million? Without some sort of tracking system, we don't know. It creates an important knowledge base that our state does not yet have. As you mentioned, we're just one of four states without this, and it strikes me as a difficult place to determine where our monies are going and how to prioritize without this information. So it's our hope that it would give researchers and providers and agencies a place to begin so other families aren't left for years trying to figure out where, why, how. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair Monson and committee members, my name is Kim Buchanan, and I am the lucky mother of three beautiful daughters who came into this world facing many obstacles. I'm here today to share my story in hopes that a birth anomaly registry would help other families to discover the causes of adverse pregnancy outcomes and birth anomalies, which hopefully can lead to prevention of those. I have identical twin daughters, Riley and Jenna, and they were born 10 weeks premature, weighing 2 pounds 8 ounces and 2 pounds 15 ounces. After a normal multiples pregnancy, I unexpectedly went to labor and quickly delivered these tiny babies who could not breathe on their own. Riley was immediately intubated and put on a respirator, and Jenna developed a pneumothorax, which is collapsed lung. Both of her lungs collapsed, and she was also put on a respirator. Jenna, after overcoming many of these common preemie issues in the NICU, the twins finally came home at 2 months old. There never was any explanation given for their preterm birth, other than the excuse that it was a multiple birth. To this day, I have a hard time believing that was the only reason when over 46% of twins deliver between 36 and 40 weeks, which is full term. 5 years later, I gave birth to my third daughter, Ainsley. My hope for Ainsley was that I would go full term. Not having a true reason for the twins' preterm birth, I was petrified of a repeat early delivery. The pregnancy was heavily monitored using ultrasound, and 33 weeks into the pregnancy, it was discovered that there was extra fluid in the baby's intestines. More testing with a specialist discovered there was an obstruction in Ainsley's bowel. To what extent and the exact location wouldn't be known until after delivery. Very unexpectedly, my water broke at 35 weeks, and 5 weeks prematurely, Ainsley was born weighing 4 pounds, 4 ounces. 8 hours after birth, She underwent surgery to repair the small intestine that was twisted, causing a severe blockage that could have ultimately killed her had we not had the early discovery. At that time, she had a section of her small intestine removed, and her appendix was also removed because it never would have been found in the upper left quadrant of her abdomen. Her entire intestinal system was malrotated 900 degrees. A year later after she was born, we noticed some issues with her again, and taking her in, her small intestine had rotated back the other way, in effect untwisting itself, and she went through another repeat surgery at that point to repair another blockage. Once again, there's no explanation for Ainsley's preterm birth nor her intestinal abnormalities. A statewide registry of such anomalies and adverse pregnancy outcomes could track other births and provide valuable information that would prevent this from happening from other families. I urge you to consider this bill. Thank you.
It takes a lot of courage to come and give your stories, but it's so important for us to hear so that you're right. We're only one of four states, and many of these, we are learning so much about our environment, et cetera, and if we don't have the mechanism to be able to determine what's happening in our state, there's no way that we can, I think, make good decisions on prevention.
Yep.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
Catherine
you.
Bradley.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Catherine Bradley, and I'm Administrator for the Office of Family Health, Public Health Division of DHS. You have in front of you my testimony. Much of the information within this is probably similar to what you heard about earlier from Ms. Rogovoy from March of Dimes. I do want to point out a couple of components about it and then speak to a couple of other additional points. As was noted earlier, approximately 25% of our pediatric hospital admissions and about one-third of the total number of pediatric hospital days are for congenital malformations. Specifically in Oregon, what we are estimating is that up to 24% of all of our infant deaths a year in Oregon are caused by birth anomalies, in comparison to about 20% in the United States. Other states are able to track the incidence of anomalies such as cleft lips, heart defects, congenital heart, kidney, and hip defects, and understand their rates in comparison to other states. Oregon just does not have any capacity for being able to do this. You all know that you're increasingly dependent on data for understanding how to direct programs at a state level as well as what we're trying to look at a county level. And our inability of really being able to understand and provide that direction is really hampering us. We have had the last of what will probably be one of our federal grants from CDC. This also is really hampering the state and being able to bring other funds in. We have twice applied to CDC for funding because CDC went through an arc where they were doing a lot of heavy funding at the state level.
When was that?
The last one we did was 4 years ago. Both of our grants were fundable, but the CDC by that time had already indicated that the money that they were putting in was to sustaining registries, not building new ones. So Oregon lost its opportunity to get the CDC funds that many of the other states were able to use to get their registries up and running. Where we're at now is that if we could fund a registry, then we would be competitive for the kind of grants the CDC puts out, where they're actually looking at particular areas of research and of interest. So, for instance, they're interested in looking at issues like fetal alcohol syndrome. They'll release a call for registries to compete for funding dollars to be able to build on that. So these kind of opportunities we no longer have access to from the CDC. So if we can get our registry up and running, then we'll have that ability. The other challenge we're running into is within the last year and a half, the last couple of years, but it's really up and running now, the Environmental Health Tracking Grant is what is getting started on our environmental health public health side. These are additional funds from CDC because they're really trying to understand what is the intersect environmental health in many of these arenas. And that's going to be a long-term agenda. There's so much we don't know about that. But one of the categories that they are expecting our environmental health program is to look at birth defects and look at that correlation potentially with environmental health. Our only capacity for doing that right now is to look at birth records. birth records don't provide this kind of information. So in essence, Oregon is not going to have this information available to really understand potential implications. So again, we've got areas that are moving forward nationally that are recognized as what are critical for states to be able to understand what's happening, and Oregon is not going to be able to be competitive in terms of getting new grants in, nor are they going to be able to look at their rates in comparison to other rates. So we're really placing ourselves at a disadvantage in terms of that. You know, and those, I think, are the main components that I really wanted to raise. It is important to understand that this is not currently in the governor's recommended budget. We do have a fiscal coming. It is being finalized. It is in the range of $600,000 to $700,000 for the initial startup, because there is quite a bit of work that has to be done in terms of information technology, the development of the registry, and an assessment. Ongoing costs will probably be more in the neighborhood of about $300,000 to $400,000, we would estimate. But that is one of the aspects that you need to be aware of.
From March of Dimes, I got a state birth defect surveillance program directory. So I started going through it to see how other states were funding it. And what I really want to bring to your attention, at least, and this was just perusing, in Ohio, they started their registry in 2006, and it's 100% funded, this was 2006, by a CDC grant. And then Maine, they started theirs, this was 1999, that's a little bit older, but again, they are... they fund it through MCH funds, their main environmental public health tracking unit, epidemiological support and abstraction. But in going through these, and I really would like to see the department take a look at how others are funding theirs. There's no way in the Ways and Means that this particular buy-in that we're going to be able to start a new program, that's just not going to happen. But I would love to send this down to Ways and Means, but I think the message is that we need to start looking at other venues and this epidemiological tracking thing. Mm-hmm. We don't know what federal stimulus monies is going to be able to use that we could hook on to. So I really hope that the DHS every year is looking at CDC and trying to get see if there are opportunities to get grants. The fact that Maine was 2006 and there were two others in here, I can't remember, that just started in the last 5 years in getting funds. So that's a message that I'd like to give to DHS. Are there any other comments? Yes, Senator Bates.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I was going to ask the gentleman who's a physician, the perinatologist, to come back up and maybe answer this question for me. My memory is, may be a little obscure on this, but my memory is that and when we look at premature deliveries, one of the leading factors for that is cigarette smoking during pregnancy. I don't know if that's, and it also leads to small birth weight babies also. Is that correct?
Well, amongst women who smoke cigarettes, there is a higher rate of prematurity as well primarily as a rate of low birth rate, more than the prematurity. However, cigarette smoking is not the main identified cause of premature labor. The main cause of premature labor is unidentified.
Unidentified. But cigarette smoking does lead to low birth rate babies, which by that fact alone have more difficulty at times. Is that correct?
Yes. Actually, back in 1990, I chaired a committee here that did a calculation. We came up with a 14-gram drop in birth rate for every cigarette per day that the woman smokes during pregnancy.
Thank you.
So that's about a half a pound per pack a day.
So it's about half a pound of body weight for the baby per pack a day cigarettes.
Yes.
Madam Chair, the reason I'm asking this question, I think you know where I'm going with it. we're going to have a cigarette tax increase in this building probably coming towards us, and we might want to take a look at that for some funding for this program. Plus, since 40% of the births are in OHP, I would expect to be a federal match with that money also. Mm-hmm. And that's two significant sources for funding for this program. It would be other funds, it wouldn't be general fund, and it would be something that might make your program work. And it's a program we need in the state, and I'd be fully supportive of, and I look at that funding with you.
All right.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Senator Morissette.
We have 8 living children. We lost 3 prematurely back in the, well, I guess it was in the 60s and 70s. My wife smoked. And when we moved from Portland to Eugene in 1960, we had twins, by the way, that were premature and died. He looked at her record and said, "I'm not going to deal with you unless you quit smoking." So she did. And the last 2 children for full term and full weight. So there is a connection.
I think there's absolutely a medical connection there, and I think it's one we can look at when we look at this bill. Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. But like the doctor said, most prematures are unidentified reasons of why it happened. And we have so many foreign substances, we're already dealing with trying to get rid of those that we feel are carcinogenic, and we have big business fighting us like crazy, but I think the more information we have, the better we'll understand our environment and therefore stop these tragic things from happening.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 460. We will be waiting for a fiscal on that, and I'm going to open a work session on SB1. Will you please read SB1?
Madam Chair, thank you for putting SB1 on the agenda as quickly as you did. Senate Bill 1 directs, mandates, and requires that all members of this committee and all staff, plus all in attendance at this hearing this morning, all members of the House and Senate, and all employees, guests, and visitors of the Oregon State Capitol on this day, March 17th, to acknowledge, recognize, and celebrate the birthday of Senator Alan Bates.
What?
Right there. I would further clarify for the record that SB1 does not stand for Senate Bill, but in fact stands for Senator Bates.
Senator Bates.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, we need a motion to adopt.
Madam Chair, with some reservation, I move the adoption of Senator Bates 1.
Okay, Senator Cruz has moved to adopt SB 1. Senator Bates 1. Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Nay.
Oh, aye. Aye.
Senator
Morissette.
Aye. Senator Morissette.
Aye. Motion carried, or is adopted. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Bates. Happy birthday to you. All right, I'll close the work session on SB1. And I would like to open a work session on HJM2.
What's he talking about?
Would you give us a summary of HJM2, or where we are with that one?
Madam Chair, 3 carryover items. That deal with Veterans Affairs, HJM2, which urges Congress to enact legislation assisting veterans' employment, HJM4, which urges Congress to pass legislation to approve funds for transition of National Guard and reservists to civilian life following active service. You want to take those 2 first?
Now, is this our first hearing of those?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I opened a work session. I meant to open a public hearing
right on
HJM2.
Two. Okay. All right, let's take them separate.
With that, Jim Willis and General Caldwell.
Good
Very good. You got me. I wasn't even paying attention. Like, what?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today in support of HDM 2, which is a memorial urging Congress to fund local veterans employment representatives, which we call LEAVERS, and the Disabled Veterans Outreach Program, which we call DVOP. The Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services agrees that veteran employment and workforce issues are a high priority for our state. LEAVERS and DVOPs play a pivotal role. And I said that slowly because last time I said pitiful. I'm so sorry. Pivotal role in helping veterans and disabled veterans prepare for and obtain employment in Oregon. However, the task force learned that these two programs have suffered significant budget cuts within the U.S. Department of Labor, resulting in a loss of services to Oregon veterans. With between 300 and 500 veterans returning to Oregon each month, the current staff of LEAVERS and DVOPs cannot meet the demand as currently staffed. Oregon needs more LEAVERS and DVOPs to help veterans find and maintain employment after service, especially in this economy. Employing veterans in return for their service to our nation is not only the right thing to do, but strengthens the economy. This memorial urges Congress to establish a nationwide public works program in conjunction with state employment departments and military authorities to provide jobs for veterans after service. The Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services sees this as a win-win for the state in that public works projects will be completed in the state with federal dollars and veterans will be hired and be employed. Lastly, this memorial asks Congress to provide a tax credit to employers who hire veterans and businesses that retain veterans to incentivize the private sector to employ veterans. Importantly, this memorial has been shared with the Oregon Congressional Delegation, which is working on federal legislation in support of these issues. HDM 2 is not just a feel-good memorial. HDM 2 is a policy statement by the state to our congressional delegation so that they can pass this important legislation. Thank you for your consideration of this memorial. I'll be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Who is the congressman that you have assigned at the federal level to champion this memorial? Or, yeah, joint memorial.
Madam Chair, I'm going to look that up.
Okay.
And if I may defer to just a moment. Oh, actually, I have found it. It's actually two. It is Representative DeFazio and Representative Schrader.
Great.
It's been referred to both those offices in the U.S. Congress.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. We fully support HGM-2 as well as the next one coming up. I think it's mindful probably and for the committee to understand that out of the roughly 3,000 National Guardsmen that we're deploying in the next couple months to Iraq, 30% of those we've gone through and evaluated every one of them as part of the processing. 30% of them are currently unemployed. Another roughly almost 20%, which is 50% of these men and women, are employed by us right now in preparation for this deployment, but theoretically will be unemployed when they get back because we will not have the federal funds to keep them on at the back end of the deployment. So I think veterans employment is a very big issue. It's a very big issue. Employment in general is a big issue. I fully concur with the with the resolution, and that if there's some sort of incentives that the Congress will enact to keep employers in the game, to keep these veterans employed, I think it would be very helpful. One thing we've learned in our reintegration process, and again, I'll invite you all to our reintegration summit this Thursday at the Anderson Readiness Center. And through that process, what we have learned is that at the soldiers, which will deal with the next joint resolution or joint memorial, when they come back initially, they're not ready for employment. Most of them aren't. And they need some time in between that deployment and when they can actually go to work. But employers are usually very eager to hire these men and women because they have some basic job traits that they covet, which is they're disciplined, they know how to come to work on time, they know when to, you know, to be there for a full week, not have to have a mental health day, the third day of work, those sort of things that these employers covet, these type of traits. So I think we've got a really good bunch of, well-trained individuals that have excellent habits and excellent traits for the workforce. It's a question of how do we link this up. Jim's mentioned the DevOps and the leavers. These people are absolutely vital. They've been cut systematically over the last decade. The money isn't there to keep them employed or keep them out there. And now we're increasing veterans at a huge rate. So I think the problem's getting worse on one end, but yet the federal government hasn't stepped up on the other. So we certainly support this. We would encourage the committee to move it along smartly, and we're looking forward to maybe Congress stepping up to the plate and doing the right thing. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Question. A question for the chair. Yeah. You said something that caught my attention, 30% unemployment and 20% working for the National Guard. When they come back, will that 20% still have a job with the National Guard, or will they be placed in the workforce also? You're looking at a potentially 50% unemployment rate amongst returning veterans who have been traumatized. Could you just give me a little more information about that?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, indeed, the roughly 20% that I spoke to are in the job sense are temporary employees. They're not permanent employees. We have, as we prepare for these deployments, we get extra money from the federal government to bring people on to do certain tasks that need to be accomplished. So we put these folks, many of them have been employed now for 6, 8, 9 months, and it's kind of ramped up to where it is today, where it's, you know, starts out kind of small and then moves up as the money becomes available. And they do everything from, you know, the packing supplies to, you know, preparation and training, et cetera, et cetera. But when they come back, they're virtually a temporary employee by the workforce standards, so they will not have any rights back to any position. There are permanent employees as well that we will be on this deployment, and they do have under SCRA, they've got the SCCRA, they've got the employment rights to come back to their position, which they will be honored. But this other group is clearly a temporary employee status. The other fascinating thing about this was that we looked at the education, who was going to school, about, not quite, but close to 10% of this deployment are currently enrolled in school in one form or another, and they're going to presumably go back and reengage into higher education. And that seems to be kind of the common theme we have seen throughout these deployments. About 30% of them are unemployed when they leave, and we've got, for instance, roughly almost 200 people, 192 I think it was, who came from Eastern Oregon who volunteered to go with this unit, even though their unit is not scheduled to go in Eastern Oregon. They have volunteered to come in. We know that probably almost in every one of those situations it's an employment issue, is that they are unemployed and they are looking for employment, and so therefore they're volunteering to go on this deployment so they can get some income.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 2, and we do have a fiscal, so I'd like to open a work session on HJM 2. Senator Morissette?
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt HJM 2.
Senator Morissette moves that we adopt HJM 2. Is there any discussion? Is there an opposition? So ordered. And Senator Schrader will carry this.
Yes.
Since her mate is going to champion this there, and we'll make sure that she puts the screws to him. Okay, all right. With that,
that is a legal.
I'll close.
A legal term that you just
close the work session on HJM 2. All right, you can stay there. I'd like to open a public hearing on HJM 4, Mr. Shook.
HJM 4, Madam Chair, urges again Congress to pass legislation and approve funds for the transition of National Guard and Reservists to civilian life following active service.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs.
I'm here today in strong support of HJM 4, which is a memorial urging Congress to establish a 90-day soft landing for returning National Guard soldiers. The Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services reviewed the current reintegration efforts when National Guard soldiers returned to Oregon from combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. The results were disturbing. While the Army will take 90 to 120 days to train a National Guardsman for war by putting them on active duty orders, which is Title 10, the Army allows less than 2 weeks for that soldier to leave combat and return to his civilian life after combat. The result has been unemployment, divorce, alcohol and substance abuse, and even suicide. Oregon is the national leader in National Guard reintegration. The first of its kind, Oregon's model has been copied by states throughout the nation. However, from the beginning, everyone associated with reintegration recognized that more time was needed for soldiers to decompress and be assessed for medical, emotional, and mental conditions. Once home from overseas, guardsmen are subjected to death by PowerPoint, briefings from every agency that offers them service. I've personally been a part of these briefings, and I can tell you that those troops just want to go home to their families and are not interested in what we have to say. Trying to provide information about health care, insurance, VA benefits, PTSD, traumatic brain injury, and education, and more for a four-day period after these troops have been kicking down doors in Iraq is a non-starter. Yet, that is what we are forced to do because these soldiers no longer are in active duty orders and need to be sent home. I would say to you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that if our nation, under Title 10 dollars, can afford anywhere from 60 to 120 days to train up these people for war, we can make an investment up to 90 days on that same Title 10 dollars to decompress them, to reunite them with their families, to prepare them for a return to full-time employment or school, and make an investment that will save us a lot of money over the decades to follow, especially when we're able to provide mental health counseling and care for those that are identified in that 90-day period. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
I think that during the Vietnam War, there was no decompression after they served the year. And I know, actually, student body president of one of our high schools in Portland that came back and ended up being a truck driver because that's where he was most comfortable in doing. And I know that if there had been some kind of decompression, reintegration back in, to get rid of or to at least accept the horrors that they experienced in Vietnam, it would have made a huge difference in his life. And I feel this is so, so important. Who's championed this in Congress?
United States Senator Wyden.
Wyden, okay.
Yes,
excellent.
Ma'am.
All right.
Cool.
Madam Chair, I concur with what Mr. Director Willis has indicated. I think the best way that I can explain this from our approach is that, as Jim indicated, we did learn from basically a hard lesson with one of our battalions that went out in 2003, and we basically got them home, said, have a good time, we'll see you in 90 days for drill. And we just didn't do a very good job. We were still busy pushing people out the front door. If you recall, the early 2000 time frame, right after 9/11, the economy dipped. We were in a quote-unquote recession then, too, I believe, according to the experts. And we had a lot of unemployed people going off in our deployment in 2004. Again, we similar to what we're dealing with today, about 50% of the 2nd Battalion, 162nd Infantry, went back or came home unemployed. We recognized this. We were trying to stand up our reintegration team at the time. I like to describe it. We were building the bike while we rode it, trying to figure out what we needed to do. We did a lot of things we just didn't understand about reintegration and about what happens after the fact. Jim's described it absolutely perfectly. Typically, there's about a 7-day period after the Army gets done with our folks at the mobilization station, and then they come to Oregon, and we have between 5 and 7 days to deal with all the things we need to deal with. We were We're mindful of the fact that these folks didn't have jobs. The economy was starting to improve. We put together a huge job fair out here at the Anderson Readiness Center. Had something on the order of 35, 40 employers, primarily from the Willamette Valley to Portland, where the unit had come from. And we knew that we had almost 300 people out of that 600-man battalion that were unemployed. We pushed them all through this process, 7 days, very delighted. I went around personally and talked to every one of the employers that were there who told us at the outset, we will offer a job on the spot. We don't care if they know what we're doing. They're willing to go to work. We want to hire them because we know the qualities they bring to the table. We will train them how we need them to do the job. And out of those 300 folks that were that day going through that last stop on their way home, nobody, not one single person took a job. And we thought, my God, this is, what did we do wrong? We were stunned. We didn't get it. We started to reassess, think about it, talk to experts, particularly in the VA, and you know, suddenly, of course, the obvious dawned on us. They're just simply unable to make that kind of a commitment. 2 weeks earlier, they were getting shot at. And all of a sudden we bring them out and 14 days later say, here's a job, take it, you need a job. The other fascinating thing about it, of course, all their income ceased to exist the next day when they went home. Thus they had some leave that they were paid for, which most of them did a couple of weeks. So within that month they were unemployed with zero income unless they went on unemployment, which most of them did. Now, I can't tell you, we didn't go through the drill of telling you how many of those folks ended up eventually taking employment, but we do know, based on anecdotal evidence, that from discussions we've had since then and lessons we've learned, that there's no way that we can expect these folks to come out of the situations they've been in and really go back to work no matter where they work. There are a few that can do that. They can change hats immediately, and depending on what particular situations they were in while they were in combat, they may very well be able to do that, but a good majority of them cannot. So we've been proposing this now since 2004 when we learned these hard lessons. We have been arguing this through the system, if you will, through the Guard system, through the Army system, and to the best of our ability to our delegation. It doesn't seem to have gotten any traction. I guess I think the Senator Wyden has truly got this as one of his highest priorities from what he's indicated to us. And I think the rest of the delegation is certainly on board. And it's going to boil down to a question of money. That always seems to be the situation. And perhaps 90 days is too long for some of them. We know that. And what we proposed is that this would be an individually based process. And then we would also put them to work in the armories and in the activities we're doing, and perhaps and also with community activities to reengage them and also assess them, get them. Some of them are going to need to want to go on to college. Some are going to need career guidance. Some are going to need career readiness certificates, these sort of things that we can actually do working through with the employment department and the education community. And we can move these people on, I think, appropriately, and also the mental health side of the activity, which is also important. But we can't even come close to that right now, and many of these folks have issues, and these soldiers will not indicate that. They know that if they get to Fort Lewis or they get to Fort Hood or wherever they left from as their mobilization station, they come back and they say, are you experiencing problems? If they say yes, they get segregated out of their group. They're not going to go home. They're going to stay on that Army post until they get through the Army medical system, which could be months, if not years. And so they've figured that out. Everybody knows that. So if they ask them, if you've got a problem, they say, I'm fine. My shoulder's fine, my foot's fine, my back's fine, my head's fine. And they get home, and then we end up dealing with those issues. And we end up dealing with a very difficult manner because now it becomes even more difficult because they're no longer on Title 10. And so we've got to work through the VA system in order to get that treatment. We don't have that available, or they spill over into the county system, which is already stretched. And they end up, we find out about it through the sheriff's office or the police department. And we've found that in many occasions. So I think if there's anything that I would tell you that we've learned from this whole process in the 7 years now that we've been actively engaged in sending Oregon men and women off to war, there's no question in my mind that this is one of the most important items, if not the most important.
Thank you. Questions? All right, we have Sherry. No, okay. All right, with that, I will close the public hearing on HJM-4, and I'll open a work session on HJM-4.
Madam Chair, I move HJM-4 to the Senate floor with a do adopt motion.
Senator Cruz moves HJM-4 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. And any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. And I'm assigning this one to Senator Schrader also. She was on the interim task force for veterans and knows a lot about this area and about this topic, so I'd like her to carry the bill. And with that, I said it was passed, so we'll close the work session on HJM-4, and we will open a, I think, work session. Do we don't need a public hearing, do we?
Madam Chair, no, we don't need a work session, but I do believe that the 7 or 8 minute video that we did not see last
time. So I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 606. Remind us what that bill is.
It's a carryover from last week, directs the Oregon Military Department and Department of Veteran Affairs to create an informational campaign on certain mental and physical disorders affecting veterans. There was a public hearing last week. We received testimony, however, the technical difficulties kept us from seeing this video that had been played last December, I believe.
And I think it's really important to know that we talked about this in the Ways and Means also, and I think education and is so important to the public, and if we can nexus the vets and suicide lines statewide.
You showed courage on the battlefield. Now, we want you to be courageous once again. If you're having thoughts of suicide, have the courage to seek help. Call 800-273-8255 and press 1. Your call is confidential. That's 800-273-TALK and press 1. We won't leave anyone behind, including you. Showed courage on the battlefield. Now, we want you to be courageous once again. If you're having thoughts of suicide, have the courage to seek help. Call 800-273-8255 and press 1. Your call is confidential. That's 800-273-TALK and press 1. We won't leave anyone behind, including you.
We have sent our courageous loved ones to fight for freedom in Iraq and Afghanistan, but when they came home, they were different. If a loved one or someone you know is struggling with thoughts of suicide, trained, caring professionals are a phone call away, ready to help. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs urges you to call 800-273-8255 and press 1. It's all confidential. 800-273-TALK and press 1. We won't leave anyone behind, including them.
As a veteran, you served your country with courage and honor. But things haven't been the same since you've been home. You're depressed, angry, or feel nothing at all. If you're having thoughts of suicide, have courage. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs wants you to call and talk with caring professionals ready to help. Call 800-273-8255 and press 1. It's all confidential. 800-273-TALK and press 1. We won't leave anyone behind, including you.
I'm Deborah Norville. If you're the mother, sister, spouse, or friend of a veteran who seems angry, sad, or isolated, you may be seeing warning signs of depression or suicide. The VA is reaching out to help, so please reach back. Even if you think you see these signs, call 1-800-273-TALK and press 1. That's 1-800-273-TALK and press 1.
It's a sad fact that some of our warriors, some of our nation's finest citizens, are wasting their lives through suicide. Suicide brings pain and heartbreak to your loved ones. VA cares about you. VA is reaching out to veterans who are thinking about suicide. So reach back now. Don't wait. Call 1-800-273-TALK and press 1. Our counselors will not share your information with anyone. Thousands of veterans have had the courage to call. How about you?
If you have the chance, will you help save the life of one of our nation's veterans? Someone you know? I'm Deborah Norville. If you're the mother, sister, spouse, or a friend of a veteran who seems angry, sad, or isolated, you may be seeing warning signs of depression or suicide. Some of these warning signs can be that the veteran seems disconnected from family or friends, starts to give away prized possessions, displays anger or rage, or overreacts to problems. The VA is reaching out to help, so please reach back. If your loved one is a veteran, and if you even think you see these warning signs, call 1-800-273-TALK and press 1. That's 1-800-273-TALK and press 1. Don't second-guess yourself. Reach out for help.
Sinise. You may know me as Lieutenant Dan from the movie Forrest Gump or as the bass player in the Lieutenant Dan Band. I've had the honor to meet many of our soldiers and veterans. It's a sad fact that some of our warriors, some of our nation's finest citizens, are wasting their lives through suicide. Suicide is not the answer. It's final. It robs you of your chances for a better life and brings pain and heartbreak to your loved ones. You don't have to go it alone. VA cares about you. VA is reaching out to veterans who are thinking about suicide. So reach back now. Don't wait. Call 1-800-273-TALK and press 1. Our counselors will not share your information with anyone. Thousands of veterans have had the courage to call. How about you? Call 1-800-273-TALK and press 1.
Judy, can you come up real quick, too? Judy Cushing runs the Oregon Partnership, and how this nexus is with the suicide hotline that we have in the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the 1-800-273-TALK number is America's lifeline number. It's an incredible, incredible line, and we are honored at Oregon Partnership to be Oregon's lifeline. So for veterans who choose to press 1, who call the line and choose to press 1, the veterans are referred immediately to the help from the Veterans Administration and those helping resources there. If they are reluctant to do that and they just dial 1-800-273-TALK, that call comes directly to us. Anyone calling from an Oregon area code, that number, the call seamlessly comes back to us. This is a line for crisis counseling, for helping people who are desperate. We will then help triage them to the helping services, whether that's the VA services that they qualify for or other helping services through the Oregon National Guard or other places. But there is a confidential, the important thing is that there is a confidential line for them to call.
Okay, questions?
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill
606
and open a work session on Senate Bill 606.
That was the Ways and Means, right?
Yes, this, as you notice, does have a fiscal, and so it will go to Ways and Means, colleagues.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 606 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 606 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 606. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill...
Here's Senator Haas.
5-6. And Senator Haas was going to be here. Will you describe the...
Madam Chair, Senate Bill... Yeah. 556 requires certain places of public assembly to have automated external defibrillator and that the owner in place of public assembly ensures that the staff person trained in the use of the automated external defibrillator is present when public place of public assembly is open to the public.
So why don't we have, while we're waiting, oh, there's Senator Hess. Come on up. It's yours.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. Mark Hass, Senate District 14. I would appreciate your consideration of Senate Bill 556, and for purposes of our discussion today, the prevailing version of this bill is found in your Dash 2 amendments. Senator Cruz and I ironed out a few things, and so that's, I think, the relevant place to look here. If it's okay, I'll just go through some of the main sections of this bill. This does require automatic external defibrillators in large public buildings, 5,000 square feet or more. That'd be the equivalent of a five-story building, or another barometer is one city block that's one story high would be about 40,000 feet. So we're talking pretty large buildings. Schools are excluded from this bill for purposes of not having a fiscal issue here. They are already requiring state buildings, in large part thanks to Senator Cruz's work in 2001, I think. And you will hear from the Building Owners and Manufacturers Association later today, and I'm proud that they are enthusiastically neutral on this bill. And we got there by working with them, and I polled lots of businesses on this, and it might surprise you because it surprised me to find out that the cost of these AEDs, and we'll have one out here in a few minutes, is really not the issue. They're down to about $1,000 a piece now. And if you look at the wide array of building codes for buildings, for heating and ventilation, $1,000 AED is really pretty insignificant. What is an issue, though, is liability. And that is probably the biggest barrier to putting in AEDs in public buildings now. And even though Oregon does have a Good Samaritan law in place, the agreement we had in order to get their enthusiastic neutrality on this was they would agree to this if we strengthen the immunity and liability language. And so that's what this does. And it essentially, as you can see, provides immunity to building owners in exchange, I think, for this requirement. I guess what I'd like to tell you about AEDs is that they work. And about a year and a half ago, I did have an occasion to actually use one in an emergency situation. It was a guy that I worked with in my interim job. And he had a seizure, what looked like a seizure, but was really sudden cardiac arrest. And he had all of the classic signs, fell to the ground, clutched his chest, turned blue. And there was an AED available. And we ran and got it. And the instructions, literally the voice commands from the unit, explained exactly what we needed to do. And we put the pads on his bare chest, and the voice command told me, analyzing data. And I was worried that, well, these things just don't work. And I was going to have to do mouth-to-mouth or something like that. And I love this guy. He was a good worker, but I didn't want to do mouth-to-mouth. And then all of a sudden the command said, administer charge. Hit the orange button. And so I did that, and it was just like you see in the movies. His whole body, 300 pounds, rocked off the ground. And we waited for a moment or two, and he was out. He had died. But after two or three seconds, he started coughing. And a few seconds later, he started blinking his eyes. And, you know, he had the proverbial comment of, you know, where am I? And they work. I've seen them work. And the irony there is we were not in the building that we work in Portland, which is an office tower in downtown Portland, one main place, 20 stories. Had we been there, he would not have survived because there's no AEDs in that building. There's probably 1,000 people that work there. And that's what I'd like to cover in this bill, is to cover buildings like that, where lots of people work, where people who are middle-aged and older work. And I see this as a fairly simple, straightforward way to get to those people. I've always said that AEDs are kind of the fire extinguishers of this new century. They're not going to be used very often, but when they're used, they'll save lives. You have lots of expert testimony behind me, so thank you for considering this.
Thank you. Questions? Yeah, Senator Cruz.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator House, I want to thank you for this. This we're continuing to expand, and bit by bit we'll get there. And, you know, I guess what I'm envious of Seattle. As I understand it, if you want to have a heart attack, that's the best place to go, simply because they're equipped to deal with it, and we're not. So, you know, we did public buildings a while back. This is another piece of it. Eventually, we'll get to schools, but we're going to have to fund those. So that will be a challenge for us next session, I believe. So, yeah, this saves lives, pure and simple. And it makes total sense. So thank you for your work on this issue.
Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Bates.
Two quick questions. Senator Hass, thanks for bringing this forward. As a physician, I really commend you for doing it. You've worked on it for many, many years. But there are two points I'd like to have you bring forward, if you could. The experience you had, tell us where it occurred. And secondly, we often focus this on middle-aged men and women who are having heart attacks, but there's another group of people who are really at risk also, and that's young people who have sudden death as a result usually of ventricular fibrillation, which is what this treats. So if you could comment on both those guys. I know you've had a personal experience with one of your constituents, I believe, who was a young man who died.
I got into this in 2001 with a 7-year-old in Beaverton at a swimming pool who died of arrhythmia. And at that swimming pool, there were not one but two doctors. One was a heart surgeon, and there were two lifeguards. And the doctor said, we didn't need any more doctors or lifeguards here. What we needed was an AED. And they lost him. He didn't survive. Since then, to help their parents grieve, they've been on a campaign to try and get more AEDs out circulating. And I started going to conferences around on this issue, and it's funny, I've been to more than a few conferences where the guest speakers start off with words to the effect of, "Hi, I'm Joe Smith, and 6 months ago I died," and then they'll pick up an AED and say, "But thanks to this, I came back." I've seen that over and over and over. And you know, the one area that got onto this really early, like, and it's not even an issue anymore, is golf courses. They had AEDs long ago because of the population, because of the heat sometimes. And so anyway, I think, you know, we're there at that place. Technology is gifted us in ways to save lives of loved ones who are being lost.
All right. Who would you want to come up next? I have a whole list. All right. We have Beth Gebstadt, Dr. Kirk Walker, and Shirley Schuler. Because I was wondering if we could have the demonstration first, and I was just...
My name is Jeff.
You'll have to sit and...
My name is Jeff Hoyt, and I'm going to do the demonstration for you. It's actually going to be a little easier if I'm allowed to stand up.
And, yes, just and for introduction.
We can make this as realistic as possible, and I can promise to talk loudly. Okay?
That's fine.
So the scenario is we have a victim that's down, and the victim is not responsive.
Do you want to... See, this is televised, so we need to just...
Turn that mic around.
Just turn the mic towards you, yeah. That'll be great.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
Okay. Either one.
Okay. So, again, the victim is unresponsive, and the victim is not breathing. We've called 911, and somebody has started CPR, and I've got to the scene now with an AED. right? So to use the AED, all we have to do is simply open the lid and follow the prompts. We don't necessarily have to know CPR. We don't necessarily have to be a highly advanced trained individual. All we have to do is be able to open the lid and follow the voice prompts.
Stay calm. Follow these voice instructions. Make sure 911 is called now. Begin by exposing patient's bare chest and torso. Remove or cut clothing if needed. When patient's chest and torso are exposed, remove square foil package from lid of AED. Tear open foil package across dotted line and remove pad.
This one's already open.
Next, separate one of the white pads completely from blue plastic liner. Begin peeling from the tabbed corner.
Do it to our desk. Okay. Yeah, they don't need it, no. The cameras are here,
next,
too.
Next, separately place the pad without the liner on the patient exactly as illustrated. This pad can be placed on either of the two locations shown.
Okay.
Next, peel the blue plastic liner off of the second white pad. Firmly place the second pad on the opposite location, exactly as illustrated.
This device will act as...
Firmly place the second pad on the opposite location, exactly as illustrated. Make sure pad connector is plugged into AED. Do not touch patient. Analyzing heart rhythm. Please wait. Do not touch patient. Analyzing heart rhythm. Please wait. Do not touch preparing shock. Move away from the patient. Shock will be delivered in 3, 2, 1. Shock delivered. It is now safe to touch the patient. When instructed, give patient 30 rapid compressions. Then give 2 breaths. Place heel of one hand on center of chest between nipples. Place heel of other hand directly on top of first hand. Lean over patient with elbows straight. Press the patient's chest down rapidly, 1/3 depth of chest, then release. Start CPR. Press, 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 press.
So from there, it would walk us through 2 minutes of CPR, and then it would reanalyze. If the patient responded to that first shock, then it would just tell us to continue CPR, continue to coach us through CPR. If the patient didn't respond to that shock, the scenario would be similar to the first one. It would tell us to step away and it would administer another shock. So that's it. And just to reiterate, folks, this isn't anything that you would use. This was here strictly for demonstration purposes, because although this guy makes a good passenger because he never says a word, I don't have to worry about backseat driver, he does not have a heart. So what I did is gave this guy a heart so that the device had something to analyze. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Beth Gepstadt, Dr. Kirk Walker, and Shirley Schrader. Oh, okay. All right.
Senator, Chair Monis-Anderson, committee members, my name is Kirk Walker. I'm a cardiologist practicing here in Salem and a member of the American College of Cardiology, Oregon chapter. Wanted to take this opportunity to talk to you about sudden cardiac arrest and the automatic external defibrillators. And I do have a handout, and on the back two pages, I have some text that's for Senator Bates, because I know he might ask me some tough questions otherwise. So there are some more data available if needed. So you've already been through some data on sudden cardiac arrest, what it is, what should be done if it happens. Can we prevent it, and are we in our community heart safe? Now, there's a semantic point. Senator Cruz said you're best having a heart attack in Seattle. You're best if you have a sudden cardiac arrest in Seattle. Yeah, and there's a slight difference. A sudden cardiac arrest is when the heart's electrical system malfunctions. The heart unexpectedly and abruptly will stop beating, and it's usually caused by an abnormal heart rhythm called ventricular fibrillation. Now the question is sudden cardiac arrest the same as a heart attack? And the answer is no. A heart attack is the death of heart muscle caused by a blocked artery supplying blood to the heart. However, dying heart muscle will frequently fibrillate and is a frequent cause of sudden cardiac arrest. And this is an important issue just when people have a heart attack. That's why you need to call 911 and don't just drive them in your car or have them drive themselves, because their heart could fibrillate at any time. So what's an AED? I can go quickly through this. It's a device for shocking the heart when it's in an abnormal rhythm. Delivers a defibrillation. It's small. You saw one up here. Looks like about the size of a laptop. Simple and automatic. So who are the people at risk? It's a worldwide killer. The average age is about 65, but as Senator Bates said, some of the most dramatic and sad events occur to young athletes, sometimes in the middle of a stadium with thousands of people around. It strikes without warning and takes the lives of about 600 people per day in the U.S. And without treatment, it's fatal. With standard treatment, 5 to 10% of the victims survive. So is there any treatment for ventricular fibrillation? And as we said, the only effective treatment is an electric shock delivered by a defibrillator. CPR is helpful, but what CPR does is it helps the heart to pump blood and oxygen to the brain and the vital tissues while you wait for defibrillation to arrive. And the EMS is incredibly fast, it seems, but sometimes it can't be fast enough. And the key to surviving sudden cardiac arrest has to do with each minute. In a cath lab, when I'm working with somebody, if they fibrillate during an angioplasty and you can cardiovert them within 30 seconds, virtually always they come back, virtually always. But every minute you wait, the success goes down. So if somebody can haul this off the wall and administer it within a couple minutes, they're going to do much better than if you give them CPR for 10 minutes and the paramedics have to try to do it. So the issue is early defibrillation. It's the only effective treatment. Time is critical. Each minute of delay reduces survival by 10%. And they can be, as was said previously, like fire extinguishers, they can be a piece of safety equipment available. Most studies have shown that they improve survival. And these are two studies showing that compared to the national average of survival at about 5% for sudden cardiac arrest, with studies using AEDs, the survival is closer to 50%. So they can be placed strategically. And who can use the AEDs? They're designed for anyone with minimal training to about a four-hour training session that can get people to where they're certified. Many people are already using them today. So any further questions, I have the text attached to my handout. And if you have any other questions, you can call us, and we can get you in touch with any cardiologist locally that would be happy to talk to you about this.
Thank you very much. Question? Yes, Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is the shelf life of this device?
You know, I don't know that. I think it's like a year or more.
You have to come to the podium then.
Buy a battery every year.
Introduce yourself.
My name is Jeff Hoyt. And with regards to your question about shelf life, as you might imagine, these devices are not used frequently. Most of the time they're hanging on the wall. They'll last for years and years and years. The technology seems to change significantly every 7-8 years. In terms of maintaining a device, batteries need to be replaced, depending on the unit, every 3 to 5 years, and pads need to be replaced every 2 years.
Thank you very much. All right. I would like to call Christine Johnson and Eddie Barnett and Shirley Schuler.
We do a battery check every year.
Okay.
Madam Chair and committee members, first time here.
Welcome.
My name is Shirley Scholer, S-C-H-O-E-L-E-Y, from Forest Grove, Oregon.
and only 4% of sudden cardiac arrest patients survive. And we were lucky enough to have a daughter that was in that percentage. On March 4th of 2008, our family realized how important AEDs are to those who experience sudden cardiac arrest. Our daughter, Shelley Copeland, 32 years old, third grade teacher, collapsed in her classroom in Hillsborough County, Tampa, Florida. She experienced a sudden cardiac arrest. She had no health or heart conditions previously. Healthy young lady. Because her school had a crisis team set up, because they had an AED in Florida schools, she lives today. The PE teacher came in, gave her CPR, the nurse came in, and started the AED procedure. Her heart had stopped for several minutes. She was dead. She was turning blue. The doctors were very concerned about brain damage because of your heart stopping that length of time. But the team at University Community Hospital in Tampa put her in a hypothermic coma for 2 days, and it brought her body temperature down to 90 degrees. And because they did that, they saved her from permanent brain damage. After 12 days in cardiac care, they implanted a defibrillator / pacemaker, and because of the quick action of a student, of a crisis team, and the availability of an AED, it saved her life. In closing, you don't get to pick where you're going to have a sudden cardiac arrest attack. It could be in a shopping center, a sporting event, waiting for a bus. But fortunately, our daughter was at the right place at the right time. Do you have any questions?
Thank you very much for that story. It really puts meaning to what this bill would actually do.
You're welcome. All right. Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Christine Johnson, and my son's name was Eddie Burnett Jr., and he died in 2005 of sudden cardiac arrest. He was diagnosed with HCM, which is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and then his diagnosis was changed, and he was released to play, back to play sports, and so he was playing varsity basketball at Madison High School. Mm-hmm. But he played for Grant High School. So at that game, he played 7 minutes the first quarter, and he substituted out and came on the bench, and he collapsed. And so there was no AED, no trainers, no doctors in the house, and basically I ran to him, helped another player lift him to the ground, and we waited for responders, which took 8 minutes. So at that point, he was brain dead, and by the time he reached the hospital, they still tried to resuscitate him for longer than what they say they usually do because he was so young and trying to save him, but he died on February 23rd, 2005. So since then, I have worked with Senator Haas before on the bill for schools and fitness centers, and that was passed. Now, I have founded a foundation in Eddie's name, and my mission is to put AEDs out there to help people not have to go through what my family's had to experience. And fortunately, Shirley had an opposite experience of what I had. And so my foundation's mission is to continue education and awareness of these diseases that are most times undetected, misdiagnosed, and most of the athletes that I know that have died from it didn't know until after the autopsy was performed that they even had a heart condition. My son was fortunate, but then it was misdiagnosed. So you have all these things out there that play, you know, factor into sudden cardiac arrest and without the AED, or with the AED, I think he would have had a better chance, because 8 minutes of response from fire and ambulance was just too much time to wait. And the other thing that I've learned since this incident is the public needs to be aware of what it looks like. I think the doctor kind of alluded to that. We thought he was having a seizure. And then it was only explained to me at the autopsy reading with the doctor that what we saw was muscle just reaction from not having air going to the brain. And if you don't know what it looks like, you won't even know to grab an AED. So, I mean, that's a big part of it, too, the awareness, education, and having the AEDs available. And I carry one in my car now, so.
So sorry for your loss, but thank you so much for committing yourself to this so that you're saving other lives. You truly are. Comments or questions?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just appreciate that, and you pointed out, I think, Senator Haas and I don't want to speak for him, but we would like to see these in schools as well, but that becomes a funding issue. Because we can't mandate on schools at this point in time the expense, but I think we at the state could make the allocation, probably not in this biennium, but I think moving forward in the next biennium, I think that will be something we will ask the legislature to consider.
I also think some schools have foundations, and they are using their foundations' monies to put these things in their schools. Yeah, Senator Bates.
Well, I'm probably prejudiced in this issue, but, you know, I've heard that argument before about not funding it. They get, and our school's budget is somewhere in the neighborhood of probably with local match and match for, from what we send them, is somewhere in the neighborhood of $12 to $13 billion for our school systems. I would imagine this is going to cost the schools more than a few million, probably $4 or $5 million for every building in the state, not just the gyms, but the actual buildings, and it's just a matter of where your priorities are. We've heard testimony today that really is striking, of course, but the sudden death of young people, the risk to our teachers, people congregate in these areas. I don't know about the rest of the state, but in Eagle Point, in Medford, Central Point, Ashland, where I come from, if you want to see a lot of people in one place, it's that Friday night football game, it's the Saturday night basketball game, it's the track meet on Saturday, it's the classrooms with the parents there, with the kids there. This is where we have the largest concentration of people. That's our best opportunity to help in this kind of a situation, and to exclude the school districts from it makes me kind of wonder. And I know we're not supposed to pass down mandates to people without funding them, but I've said this before and got myself in all kinds of trouble for saying it, and I'll say it again, and I'll probably get hammered tomorrow, but we write a $6 or $7 billion check every 2 years to the school districts, and we do have some oversight about how that money's spent, but not a great deal. We just had a stimulus package to them. You know the trouble we had with that. And so this is the kind of mandate that I would like to see put in place, an exclusion of schools from this. I realize the hard work that these two gentlemen have done getting it this far. It really gives me difficulty. And I'd be much more supportive of a bill that said we're going to mandate this in schools the next, you know, 24 months, the next 2 years, you've all got to step up. They're $1,000 a piece now. They're nothing. We tried this out on fifth grade kids one time to see if they could do it, and we just had the machine to them, and those fifth graders figured out within a couple of minutes what they're supposed to do with them and how to do it. I mean, if a fifth grader can do something like this and save lives, I don't know why we're holding back on the schools, so I'll get off my soapbox here and control myself, but it needs a change. We should have these in our schools, just like Florida does.
Thank you. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How many AEDs do we have in this building, and where are they?
I have no idea.
Well, Madam Chair, when I came to this building 10 years ago, we had none. And I worked with Ramona Kennedy to immediately place them in this building. They're on two floor areas. They're readily available, and staff knows where they're at. And I was hoping that Senator Haas would give us the rest of the story. Mm-hmm. The AED he used was in this building. and he was here with one of his fellow workers at the Secretary of State's office. This gentleman collapsed in front of him, and it was just very bizarre that in a building that hadn't had him a few years before, Kennedy and I got him put in. Senator Haas, who was so interested in this issue, is in that position at that time for this gentleman. One of the workers immediately ran and got it for him. By the time they got back, the gentleman turned blue, and gray is actually what the look they look at. He put it on. He said he was just terrified to use it, but went ahead and used it and was successful in resuscitating this gentleman. By the time the EMTs came in, they took him off the hospital. So, yes, they're here. They're in place, and they've been used at least one time that I know of. We need to do this more often.
Can I say one more thing? I just wanted to mention, too, when he was talking about the school thing, one thing I realized, too, is that a lot of times in cases of disaster, schools are used as the places where people go to for shelter. So not only is it important for the teachers and the students and the custodians and that's there on a daily basis, but it's, if they're used in disaster plans, there's people from all kind of backgrounds and health conditions, and so that's important. And the other thing, when he mentioned it, cost them $1,000. To some people, when you're doing the budgeting and it's never happened to you or you never had the experience, that sounds like a lot of money. But for me, I can't even tell you how much money I would give to have my son back. So $1,000 in somebody's life is kind of like, you know, it's not, no comparison. It's no comparison. So I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you.
Yes.
You can't put a price on anybody.
No.
It's a bottom line. And I know there's a crunch with the schools and supporting them. I'm a retired school office manager, and I know about this. But I just read an article about two 15-year-old boys that collapsed on a lacrosse field in New York. They had no AEDs. And that father said, you know, $1,000. That's all it would have taken.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Testimony. One more, Bill Cross, quickly.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today on behalf of BOMA, Building Owners and Managers Association, primarily commercial building owners in the Portland metro area. We have worked with Senator Haas on this issue for over a year, maybe even 2 years now since last session, and certainly have appreciated the need and certainly the the deaths point to the need of these devices. As commercial building owners, our biggest concern was the liability, and while we do have a Good Samaritan law in place, there is still a cost for trying to comply with the Good Samaritan requirements. And simply maintaining a device, having a trained person on staff, and when you're talking about commercial building owners, buildings, well, they're open 24 hours a day. We have tenants in there 24 hours a day. And so some of the original criteria of the statute were very onerous in the sense of our liability exposure. The Senator has worked with us on the -2 amendments, which would basically require commercial buildings of 50,000 square feet or larger to have a defibrillator in them. There would be liability would accrue if indeed they didn't comply with that requirement. They would be obviously liable if they didn't, through gross negligence, maintain the device. But it would not require them to have a trained staff person on premises 24 hours, which would obviously extend or involve greater costs. This amendment, if adopted, would allow us to, I think would minimize insurance premium costs for having the machines and the exposure, and would also make it possible for us in our contracts with our tenants and their guests, staff, employees, etc., have fairly nominal exposure, and would allow us to go ahead and do the right thing.
Question? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will wait for the fiscal, if there is one. We don't have the statement. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 556 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 381. Sure. Please give us a summary.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 381 requires health benefit plans to provide coverage of medically necessary treatment for traumatic brain injury and adds orthotic and prosthetic devices to the list of required coverage.
All right, Sherry Stock and, well, Tootie Smith. Oh, Senator Morissette. Awesome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. We're here today to, and I will be very brief, talk about Senate Bill 381. And if you look at the bill, I'll give you some reference points in terms of the statute. Okay, this bill requires health benefit plan to provide coverage for medically necessary treatment for traumatic brain injury, adds orthotic and prosthetic devices to list required coverage for health care services, and so on. Now, what has that got to do with TBI? Nothing, nothing, nothing. So I called Lori Freeman a little while ago, and I said, Lori, what's going on? She said, well, we forgot to add that to the statute last time. So we added. The references here are, you can see them in dark, in the bold print, 743A. Now, A is an additional to 743. I said, what happened? Where do you find A? She said, well, look at the end of 743, and you'll see a whole new section that we didn't have room for. And so they added that. So 743A and 743A. 743A020 and 743A144 deal with those two issues, and if you look in your handy-dandy statutes like I did, you will find them all listed here. So there's... I just didn't want that to add to the confusion of talking about this bill. Okay. There are a number of people who've come from distances to testify. I have been working with the Traumatic Brain Injury Association since 1901. I've gone to the conferences. I've served on the board. This is an extremely important issue. We can't identify them by looking at people. You can't identify them by talking to them. And as you will hear, there are people who are professionals who can no longer practice their profession because of this injury. Injuries can come from a variety of sources. They're cumulative. So you can have a series of concussions that will do major damage, and that is irreparable in many cases. However, there is training, vocational training, that needs to be done to mitigate some of the symptoms so people can continue with their life. There are two fact sheets that were put together by Sherry Stock. These are really important. They talk about insurance companies who do cover, insurance companies who do not cover. They talk about the state of Texas that, in one of these, that... okay, anyway, the state of Texas passed this twice in 01 and again in 07 and found that they did a fiscal a second time and found that it cost $1 per person to implement this. So $1 per person is what the insurance companies had to pay in addition. There are a number of insurance companies in Oregon who do cover it. There are some who don't. Kaiser covers it in the Portland area, but not in the rest of the state. This is not a big spending item for the insurance companies, but it certainly has an impact on the people's lives who are affected by it. So with that, I will stop and turn it over to Tootie Smith, and there are others here.
Thank you, Senator Morissette. We appreciate your diligence in this matter. I'm Tootie Smith with the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. Like the senator said, this targets approximately less than 1% of the claims submitted to insurance companies. The problem is, if insurance companies don't cover cognitive rehab, rehabilitation, say a person gets a brain injury, as myself, I want to go back to work. So what they do is they take in the state of Oregon through their state, through our state vocational programs, will pay for my cognitive rehabilitation. And to get me back to where is probably as far as I can go, depending on the severity of my brain injury, to be an employable person back in today's society. So right now, if insurance companies don't pay for this, which we think the cost is minimal, the tab is picked up by the state of Oregon for the people who request it. So with that in mind, we're going to have some more of our people come up and testify today. Sherry would like to testify. She will answer questions, but she has a terrible cold, losing her voice, and she has a cough. So with that in mind, could we have some of our folks come up?
I'd like those who have come some distance. I know that Jennifer Dale has taken the day off. Why don't you come forward? Is there someone else that's come from outside? Okay.
Thank you, madam. Good morning. My name is Jennifer Diallo. I'm a social studies teacher at the Eugene International High School in Eugene, Oregon. 2 years ago today, I fell in the shower, knocked my head against the side of the tub, and my life changed. For several weeks, I was unable to leave my home. For several months, I was unable to drive, to ride a bike, to complete a sentence, to handle being in a room with lights like this, to watch a video. You noticed I covered my eyes when it came up next to me because I still, you know, with the sound and light that's that close, have some issues to deal with. I'm a single parent. I'm a school teacher. I don't make a lot of money. I don't have the money for expensive treatments. But I was really happy to know that as a state employee and teacher, I have good insurance. Unfortunately, I found out that my good insurance didn't really cover any of the things I needed to recover from my brain injury. I'd had concussions as a child, you know, knocking my head on this, falling off a horse, doing different things, and apparently this cumulative effect was what caused such a severe reaction this time. I hit my head at a part of the brain where three different areas joined together, so a lot of different things were touched by it from the different lobes that were affected. I would be adding up numbers to pay bills and start subtracting instead. I mean, just odd things that I couldn't really control. It was very difficult to function in daily life without some kind of help. I also, as a teacher, I read a lot of books about how children learn. I learn a lot about the brain and how it functions. And I also hear a lot in Eugene about how researchers at the University of Oregon and our own community are making these great strides in brain research and finding out all these wonderful things. They can do these incredible scans that show what part of your brain is affected by any little thing in your thinking, and they can see where you're thinking in your brain. None of those technologies were available to me as a traumatic brain injury patient. What was available was a CAT scan. That's all the insurance would pay for, and CAT scans, as we know, don't really show anything unless the damage is pretty severe. So if you're about to die, it might show up. 3 weeks after my injury, I heard tinkling the glass sounds in my head and asked my doctor, "What is this sound I keep hearing, like breaking glass?" And she said, "Oh, that's the hematoma breaking up." And I was stunned because I didn't realize there was bleeding in my brain. I might have been, I was barely doing anything at that point, but just to know that my brain was bleeding, and you know, and I knew about these SPECT scans and PET scans and all these different scans you could have, but they weren't available to me. And on the CAT scan, you could see nothing. Imagine the feeling that you have knowing that you're bleeding in your brain. You know, can someone do something, please? Well, no, your insurance doesn't cover that. My doctor prescribed cognitive therapy, vision therapy. I needed some vocational rehabilitation. I needed filters on the lights in my classrooms, like these filters. I needed to have bulletin boards taken off of the back of the room so I wouldn't be visually distracted when I was able to go to work a year and a half later. And all of those things were only made available because of a wonderful vocational rehabilitation counselor at the state of Oregon. And I know that we have Iraq veterans coming back from war that are suffering from these traumatic brain injuries by huge numbers. And I know that our state resources are going to be stretched. And I really just strongly feel that our doctors should be making the decisions and not our insurance companies. I see the vision therapy place where I was able to go for a time while I was in vocational rehab also treated athletes at the University of Oregon so that they could catch balls better. And when I went back to school and I saw that these services that are available are so expensive that families can't afford them, insurance companies won't cover them, and yet, you know, athletes can use these services to go, to learn, you know, to be able to better focus, to catch a ball. And I have students who can't read very well or can't write. And I recognize from my own therapy, one thing about my brain injuries, it's made me so much more aware of some of the learning challenges my students have with different, you know, attention deficit, with different reading issues that can be caused by visual problems. And you know, these therapies just aren't available to most people. They're really only available to a small number. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm used to teaching, so I talk a lot. I'm sorry. So that's really what my main point is. I really think that doctors should be able to prescribe your treatment and not insurance companies.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
My name is Jerry Cohen. I provided some written background to you. Unfortunately, I inadvertently printed something that I prepared 2 years ago in conjunction with another bill about which I testified. The only modification to that I would say is that my daughter is now enrolled in the OIT Diagnostic Medical Sonography Program. I was a passenger in a vehicle which left the road at 100 miles per hour, rolled, spun, and ended upside down. At that time, I was an attorney. I went back to my office. A week later, my symptoms did not resolve. I was given a neuropsych examination. My health insurance did not cover any of the cognitive rehab. I could not afford it. I spent 6 months looking for work, could not obtain employment, so went through the Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program of the State of Oregon. As part of that, I did receive some cognitive rehab and some vision therapy. Now, in conjunction with my application for SSD, I was given a second neuropsych exam approximately 2 years after the first and after the cognitive therapy. It showed improvement, and I can only attribute that to the cognitive rehab. In addition, my ability to remember and to recognize things through vision was less than the first percentile during the first neuropsych, and I had improved to the 34th during the second test. I did not receive significant cognitive rehab until 3 years after my accident. I can only suspect that had I been able to obtain it earlier, I would be much improved, although I am doing very well and utilize my skills as a member of the Board of Directors of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon.
Thank you.
May I briefly, Jerry? A personality change as well?
Yes.
I asked her one time if I would have liked her better the other way when before the accident. She said, no, you would like me better now. Is that right?
Correct. I laugh a lot more, and I'm a lot more spontaneous.
So that's another aspect of this is personality changes.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I've seen quite a few of these. I have to tell you, the personality disorders that occur after this, unfortunately, they are not usually making someone to be more likable. These people have difficulty with impulse control. They have difficulty with anger issues, especially the first couple of years after the accident. Some of that does get better with time, but it takes treatment. It makes their lives very, very difficult for them and their family, and they commonly don't have insight about themselves. They don't realize something's happened to make that that much different. And so it's a very difficult situation, and it takes time, patience, a lot of effort by families usually, and a lot of treatment before they can resume their lives. It takes years, mm-hmm. if they ever can.
Senator Bates, I would like to validate what you're saying. I do suffer from some of those issues, and no, 7.5 years out, I may be beginning to recognize when that pressure is building, but it has been a very difficult process.
It's hard.
And I plan to, because we don't have floor session, go after 10, because I want to make sure there are a lot of people that I want to make sure that we hear, except for the insurers, we can hear from you another day. Okay.
Yes, my name is Greg Lowell, and I support this bill. I'm going to be brief because my colleagues here pretty much covered most of everything I was going to say, and Senator Bates is absolutely correct in the issues that he stated, too. I was one of the lucky ones because I got hurt on the job, so I was through safe, but I also lost my job. I was assistant building official for Linn County for 9 years and was unable to mentally keep up with that work, so I got released from Linn County. I then got a hold of the Burke program, got rehabilitated, and actually now I'm the building official for the city of Sweet Home, so it's an upgrade in my career as far as me moving forward with my life. But without the help of Burke and a rehabilitation program, I'd probably still be unemployed and on taxpayer dollars at this moment. So I think it's going to be an additional cost to health care providers, but in the long run, it's going to be cheaper overall because people like me would be able to function and be in society, you know, as a taxpayer instead of a burden to society. So I think the cost will outweigh itself in the end. It's just, you know, there's people I know, there are several colleagues of mine that have had minor brain injuries, but they weren't either identified or like she was saying, that the healthcare didn't pay for it. And I personally know of two individuals to where they're unemployed, they have no job, they're financially, you know, in ruin, and they're probably going to lose their home and their car and everything. And just because of brain injury, that could be retrainable to where they could be a workable person again. But because of the way the system is, there's really not a lot of help for people like us out here. And I was one of the fortunate ones that finally did get some help and was able to move my career forward and up. The problem that I've encountered with the whole system in general is that brain injury, like the senator said, is you can't see it. So it's hard to fathom what's going on. It's not like a broken arm or a broken leg. And that was where my downfall was. I was in an injury in 2003, went through extensive rehab for a year, and I even hired a personal trainer at the gym and stuff, and I was in the best shape of my life in 2004, hiked many miles up in the mountains and up in the elk, but my brain was mush, you know. I was like, I had the brain of a fifth grader, but I was, you know, people say, man, you're in great shape, but mentally I was not there. So it took the Burke program to get my brain back up to be functional in society. So that's just all I have to say. I think you guys are aware of the issues that are at hand.
Thank you. All right, Thomas Boyd and Marty Johnson.
Okay, just looking at the time, I'm going to completely restructure this, and I am going to watch my watch. My name's Tom Boyd. I've got over 25 years of experience working in brain injury rehab.
I'm just going to make several points here. First of all, there have been questions raised about whether cognitive rehabilitation is effective. And I think that the larger scale study that's been done, it looked at over 170 studies, found very good support for the efficacy of cognitive rehabilitation. We really need to move beyond that argument. That's a non-argument at this point. I don't think even the folks who originally made that are contending that as strongly. It is a medically necessary part of a comprehensive effort to rehabilitate a person. Is it more medically necessary to provide life-saving medications than to provide the memory training that a person needs in order to be able to take them safely? You've got to be able to take them well. You might have a seizure. You might have other medical complications. Is it more medically necessary to train a person with a brain injury to be able to physically walk across the street than it is to train them to compensate for visual neglect and look for the vehicles that might hit them when they cross the street? It's part of the whole package. It's ironic for me because I think in some ways cognitive rehabilitation is the most important deficit after most brain injuries. It is the most pivotal area in which we need to work, and it's tied into so many other aspects of life. If we treat these early on, people can have much better quality of life. They can live independently. They may be able to return to work. If we don't treat them, the consequences are going to be very dire for them and expensive for our state. We'll see them invoke rehab. We'll see them in Medicaid. We'll see them in the mental health system. These are not speculations. These are hard findings. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Marty Johnson. I'm a vocational counselor at Community Rehab, and I'm speaking for our program coordinator, Jan Johnson, in support of Senate Bill 381. Wanted to add a little bit about cognitive therapy. In cognitive therapy, a speech therapist typically works on memory training, attention, structuring daily activities, initiation and follow-through of tasks, planning, learning how to do transportation. It can be as simple but as important as taking medications like Tom talked about, or as complex as learning job skills and getting back to work. The people who have had cognitive therapy for mild traumatic brain injuries go back to work at a very high rate and successfully. It reduces the need for Social Security disability, and most importantly, it has a huge impact on their self-worth. Blue Cross clients that are told that they can't have cognitive therapy are devastated. They are not open, and I would like to say that, you know, with the financial difficulties our state is in, Oregon Voc Rehab is not paying for services. They're in a order of selection, so that means you go onto a waiting list, and even though you have a brain injury as a number one priority, they may be months until they can get those services, and then they can only get services if there is a potential for them to go back to work. Clients with these insurances that don't pay for their cognitive therapy may not be able to go to work, and they may not be able to just do their daily activities as they could. And so if they are able to use Voc Rehab services, then we have taxpayers paying for services that should be provided by a person's insurance company. So thank you for paying attention to this injustice, and I hope we can work towards correcting that.
Do you know how many people that are in cognitive therapy in your organization have insurance and those that don't? And if you don't, if you could get that information back to us, because I know we'll be hearing this again, since we can't hear it all today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, Kathy Domingo and Kate Robinson.
Good morning. In the interest of time, I'll get going. My name is Kathy DeDomingo. I am a speech pathologist by training and a compliance officer for Progressive Rehabilitation Associates, the Brain Injury Rehabilitation Center, BRIC program, as you heard Mr. Llewellyn referring to. I'm got a whole lot list of things I could go talk about. You have my written testimony, but I do want to clarify a couple of things. You heard that Kaiser only provides therapy in the Portland area. Kaiser's policy is that they do not cover cognitive rehabilitation. That's their medical policy. We are fortunate in the Brain Injury Rehabilitation Center to have had a long-standing relationship with a nurse case manager who understands and values the rehabilitation services that are so important to Kaiser members with a brain injury. Therefore, we have a specific contract with Kaiser to provide those services. That's why only Portland members in their surrounding area are able to get cognitive rehabilitation services from our program. When it comes to dealing with insurance companies, there are only two in the state who don't cover cognitive rehab. They are the two biggest insurers in the state. When a member calls to get information about their benefits, the information can be quite confusing.
But I assume that's Providence and Regents?
No, actually, Providence changed their policy just last year, so Providence now covers it. Regents is the other insurer. Kaiser, as I said, doesn't cover it. They do cover specifically in Portland.
Okay.
Because of that contract.
Okay.
Oftentimes, when a member calls to find out about what their benefits are, they're told, yes, you have X number of visits for physical, occupational, and speech therapy, which is fine, but unless you know what codes to ask about, what information specifically to ask for, you'll be told information that says, yep, you've got it covered. But once they come to our program and find out, well, these are the codes we're going to be using, this is the type of service that we're recommending for you, it takes some digging to find out what in fact is going to happen. We have to tell patients day in and day out, sorry, this is not going to be a covered benefit for you. And by the way, we need you to sign this financial waiver that says you will be financially responsible for these services, which are not inexpensive as is healthcare in general right now. We've seen families have to tap into their life savings, take out second mortgages on their homes just to get the needed services that they need in order to return to being functional members of society. The average time that it takes for someone to get to our program right now is 11 months. But our range can be from anywhere from 2 months on out to, I've seen, 300 months. So this means someone who's had a long-standing brain injury. Right? When you take the outliers out, 11 months is how long it takes to get to an outpatient level of care. The continuum of care for a rehabilitation survivor is pretty lengthy. It starts in the acute care hospital. It goes on to the inpatient rehabilitation program. Sometimes it starts in the ED and goes straight to the outpatient department. In between there can be different other levels of care. A brain injury is not like a broken arm. 6 weeks later, you put a cast on somebody, it's a strengthened area, and you take the cast off and everything's done. A brain injury takes a long time to heal. Therefore, it takes a lot of work to get them there. It's not an inexpensive disease or disorder to approach. However, the fiscal impact, as you've heard from from Senator Morissette, from the Texas study, was that it's $1 per claim. It's not much. But what we are talking about is getting people back to being able to be productive members of society, returning them to taxpayer status, which means they can contribute like the rest of us to the state's ability to take care of those who are less fortunate.
And if you can give us any information on how many have insurance and those that do not.
From our referral logs, I can tell you, yeah.
Okay.
I don't have it on the top of my head, but
yeah.
I can certainly submit that.
Thank you.
And
you can get it to Mr. Shook or to Sherry or Tootie. Yeah,
okay.
Who
thank
can
you.
Get it to Mr. Shook.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chair, committee members, my name is Kate Robinson, and I'm here to speak from the heart. And I'm trying to... wasn't going to do this. Wasn't going to get emotional. So 17 years ago, at the age of 16, I was the only survivor of a private plane crash. And I had a traumatic brain injury and subsequently had brain injury to remove swelling from my brain. I was in a coma for 3 weeks, and I was in acute care for 6 weeks. So some of the effects of my brain injury and common effects of a brain injury. I was very confused after my coma. I started speaking French after my coma rather than English. I had to relearn how to walk and talk. I lost all memories of my former life before the age of 16, and I still, unfortunately, don't remember my life before the age of 16, retrograde amnesia. I'd forgotten everything I'd learned in school, math skills, history, science, but I remembered the French. I didn't remember friends that I had since the first grade. They came to visit me in the hospital and had no idea. I had a very short attention span, about 20 seconds. I talked to my mom before coming over here, and she had to tell me all this because I don't remember. I regressed emotionally. I was childlike and inappropriate. I was very socially isolated, suffered from depression long after my injury, angry about a lot of issues, became tired very easily, and some of these things I still deal with, and had decreased mobility and loss of coordination. So the therapy I received, 6 weeks of acute care and 6 weeks of inpatient care, which was covered by insurance. After that, my mom tells me I was not ready for the real world. After I was discharged, I needed additional outpatient, cognitive, physical, and speech therapy that wasn't covered. Fortunately, my family had the funds to pay for this, which is why I'm where I am now. My family paid out of pocket for outpatient rehab, an educational psychologist, a psychologist, a physical therapist, massage therapist, and on and on. currently I have my master's degree in rehabilitation counseling, and I'm specialized in working with individuals with brain injuries. And I've seen firsthand you know, the difference between someone like me, whose family was able to pay for outpatient therapy that insurance didn't cover, and individuals who only got insurance that was allotted to them. And the difference is staggering. I work with individuals who, you know, have to live in assisted living, are not able to return to work or school because they didn't get the therapy that they needed. And I just want to make a couple important points. It is impossible for brain injury survivors to recover physically and cognitively in the time that insurance allows. Recovery is a long, slow process that cannot be reached in a matter of weeks or a few months. I'm sorry I'm so emotional. I didn't expect this. If I didn't have family with financial resources to pay for therapy out of pocket, I wouldn't be where I am today as a professional counselor. And I probably wouldn't have finished high school.
Thank you so much.
Sorry.
And you are...
I did not expect that. It just came out of
That's all right. You're a case, basically, that shows what cognitive therapy can do. And you were able to gain these skills back and get your master's and give back to society. So
yeah.
It's so important. So I thank you so much for having the courage to come talk
thank
to
you.
Us.
Thank you, and I'm usually not this emotional.
Hey, don't apologize.
Thank you.
All right. With that, Robert Burns and Anya Burry.
Good morning. I will be very brief. My name is Robert Burry. We both have the same last name. Anya is my daughter. And Anya suffered a traumatic brain injury a couple years ago, and she'll tell you about that. I'm going to let her do most of the talking because she's much more articulate than I. But the process of this whole thing was really a process of discovering after she'd had the injury that she did have a brain injury, and then our school wasn't particularly well prepared to deal with those types of injuries. It's an athletic injury. Moving on through the system, that we needed to get a neurologist, and our neurologist recommended that we seek vision therapy and also cognitive rehab therapy for Anya. And fortunately, we were able to find it in our town. I mean, we've got great providers there. And it's a remarkable thing, and Anya can tell you a little bit more about the therapy itself. I can just tell you that the first 3 months involved 56 different appointments for Anya between therapists and tutors and doctors, and in the middle of that whole thing, we also discovered that our insurance company wouldn't pay for it, Regents. And sort of having to fight that battle at the same time as you're dealing with this, I mean, it's an amazing thing that to go through that process, and it was discouraging, and we've actually taken Blue Cross to court to try to get them to pay for the cognitive rehab, because we feel that it was so critical, and mostly just so that others down the road won't have to go through the same battles that we've had to go through. They will tell you that it's not effective, and we just know that's not true because we've seen it at work. And they will tell you that it's not medically necessary, and I would suggest that's probably an argument you could make. But I guess you could say the same thing for a broken arm. I mean, you could let it heal up by itself. But the reality is, if it's going to heal properly, it needs to have a cast. If it's going to heal rapidly, and if it's going to heal well, and this is exactly the same situation. This is something that is critical to get folks back to where they need to be. So I'm going to let Anya tell you where she is now and what her process was.
Hi, I'm Anya. As I blew out the candles on my 16th birthday, my main wishes were for a successful school year. Maybe a car and a boyfriend with that would have been really nice. Two and a half weeks later, I was at volleyball practice as a junior varsity team, and I scrimmaged it against the varsity team. This was really common. We had fun doing it. Spirits were high. I was in my position. And so was the varsity player who went for a hit, commonly known as a spike. Truly one of her greatest hits, and I received the hit to my left temple where there's minimal protection of the brain. I, as advised by the athletic... what's Paul's name?
Trainer.
Athletic trainer, yeah. We just call him Paul the trainer guy at our school, so it's not really that formal. And my coach advised me to take some Tylenol, sleep it off, and take it easy for the next few days. I went home in a hysteric state, and the next day I tried going to school but was promptly removed, for my brain functioning and speech abilities were severely challenged. As my dad would have mentioned, I saw Dr. Dunphy, my personal physician, and was then recommended to Dr. Kathleen Wilkin in Eugene, who is a practicing neurologist. She recommended that I go to Community Rehabilitation Services of Oregon. There I met Jan Johnson, who upon meeting her, I felt really comfortable because I was finally at a place where someone would know what I was going through. I entered cognitive rehabilitation correctly so because I was convinced that cereal and celery were the same thing. I entered memory rehab with Helen Shearer, doing exercises that for a functioning person would be simple and basic, yet for a girl who couldn't recall breakfast or the dinner she had had the night before were extremely challenging. Psychological aid determined that I had severe depression along with a sleep disorder and incredible levels of hormones that were not going to be even, and my dad could really attest to that. serious fatigue left me in bed many days until I was assigned a teacher from the 4J district who stayed with me for nearly 7 months and aided my return to classes. I first started off with math because, thank goodness, I was blessed with math skills from my father. At school, the lights were too bright. The books were too confusing, and it was generally just too loud. Reading challenged me and frustrated me the most, for my misalignment forced me to reread paragraphs and lines repeatedly. And if you essentially read the Odyssey with one eye, then reread it with the other eye, that's what it was like for me. And over time, Homer just really annoyed me. Like, just couldn't handle Homer. I phased out of rehab, completing Helen Shearer's lessons and feeling more confident with myself. Cereal was finally cereal, and celery was actually crunchy again. My vision needed aid, and per recommendation by Dr. Wilkin, I entered vision rehab under Dr. Margaret Foley's care. I was prescribed glasses with a prism implemented in them, allowing for my eyes to realign horizontally and vertically. They also had magnification so I wouldn't hold a textbook 4 inches from my nose. I continued vision rehab to the point that my vision was the same prior to the accident, if not tremendously better. Today, I still wear the same frames, but the lenses have no prism, no need for alignment, and minimal need of magnification. The use of the magnification is to preserve my use of vision so that when I turn 41, I'll be needing reading glasses as opposed to the national average of 40. It is now 2 years and 10 days shy of 6 months since I was injured. I am in AP Literature, currently studying Ken Kesey and Kurt Vonnegut at the same time, Spanish 4, AP Environmental Studies, and college-level math courses. As my father would have mentioned, I'm attending University of Portland in August based on an academic scholarship due to my 3.75 GPA that I've somehow kept over 4 years, 3 of them with a traumatic brain injury. And as a side note, just yesterday I played 18 holes at Bandon Dunes Golf Course, which is incredibly fun. The reason why, though, that I play golf is to prevent any further accidents that could leave me with traumatic brain injury. I was a volleyball player, but now I play golf. And I can tell you the difference is staggering, but ultimately a lot more fun.
Yeah.
So thank you for allowing me to speak, even though I kind of ran through it, and thanks again.
Well, thank you so much for coming and sharing your story with us. It's really important to hear you, and you just recently had it. I mean,
yeah.
2 years ago.
2 years and 6 months.
We wish you the best.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And you too.
Thank you very
and
much.
Thank you for caring for her so much to get her to where she is.
Well, yeah. I mean, anybody who's a parent knows that you would do anything you can for your kid, and fortunately we had the resources to be able to do it, and others do not.
Yeah, thank
Madam
you.
Chair.
Yes, and
I didn't know, Bob, that you were a math whiz.
Well, that may have been slightly overstated. Not that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, is Chris Sandberg the only other? Yeah.
And Bob Junior.
Well, Bob, can you come back?
Sure.
I can forego if you'd like. My story is very similar.
Well, why don't you come forward? But Bob's in the building a lot. And so he can come out. And Sherry, can you come back or not?
I can come back when I cold.
Yeah. So when we follow this up. And I see now that Regents is in the room. Do you have to speak today? Okay. Because you're not on the list. Okay. All right.
Thank you for hearing my story. I'll be quick. I was in an industrial...
Oh, introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. My name is Chris Sandberg. I went through the rehabilitation program back in 1994. My accident was an industrial accident. I fell off a 14-foot step ladder onto a concrete floor head first. Was life-flighted from there to U of O Hospital. Spent a week in intensive care, then a week in the rehabilitation program that was an in-house program at Good Samaritan. And then I went on to the community rehabilitation program that's in Portland. As my accident was quite severe, I also had broken bones and so forth in the fall at the same time, so I had other issues as well. But after coming out of the rehabilitation in hospital, I had a lot of anger issues. I had no knowledge of my young children, my oldest being 8, and I really was very little to speak. My mother heard me use swear words that I didn't even know that I really knew, which was quite surprising when she saw me in the hospital. As the rehabilitation program, I got into that. It helped me very significantly in monitoring that kind of behavior, as well as bringing me cognitively to a level that I could function much, much better. I used a lot of the program issues. We used a planner and a scheduler to be able to pace our days and make sure that we were able to do what we needed to do at the proper times. I did some problem solving through that to be able to figure out how to analyze or take care of the issues that I was trying to deal with. The cognitive issues of it was quite significant in terms of memory loss and so forth, so we did a lot of training with that. was very beneficial in that respect. In fact, I still use a lot of the strategies that they taught me many years ago today to accomplish what I need to do. I had attention deficit disorder, which is more than just the normal. Just like the cognitive memory things, you know, somebody says, well, I forgot this or that. Well, mine's just the next level up from that, and so it makes it more difficult to remember some things. So some of the things was taking notes or repeating information back to people, which is extremely beneficial as a skill to be able to deal with some of the issues that I have still a little bit, but I've gotten a lot better. Through the help of the cognitive coaching, and I had a job coach that actually followed me through my rehabilitation with my employer. I stayed with the employer that I had the accident with. They were very beneficial, very helpful. The insurance did cover it. It happened to be a smaller insurance company instead of the larger ones, so I was very beneficial in that respect that they were able to put me into the program and it was able to provide me the coverage. But I think it's paramount. My wife definitely says that without that program, it would have possibly been very hard for our relationship to have continued. I've been married over 30 years, and I'm very thankful that the program was able to help me get that far. Post-accident, I was in training to be an electrician when the accident occurred. I since have gone on and gotten my general journeyman's license and on to my supervisor's license, which is an extensive feat, and I think that the program was paramount in helping me prepare and get ready for that from a cognitive standpoint. So I still have deficits. My body temperature's right, but I always think I'm cold. Sleep is an issue. I need more sleep. Even though I'm getting older, I just turned 50, it still matters that I have more sleep than I used to. And so that's an issue that you have to watch for. And I think one of the people earlier mentioned, you can't see it on the outside.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it difficult for some people to understand about traumatic brain injuries. And I hope that through this legislation that we might be able to get through is that the insurance companies do understand that it is something that will benefit people and help society in the future to keep these people and myself and others involved in society instead of becoming dependent upon the system.
Excellent.
So thanks for hearing me. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. With that, I think the rest of the I don't think there's anyone else in the queue that came. So we will continue this. I'm not sure when it will be scheduled, but Sherry, will you please, and Trudy, make sure that we have information regarding what numbers we're talking about. Same with Regents. We'd like to know what kind of numbers there are that you cover with, in if at all, with cognitive therapy.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we will have General Caldwell here next time also to testify because this is a huge issue. It's not a funding issue necessarily with the veterans, but it is a huge issue that we don't recognize by looking at people.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for staying so late. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 381, and we are adjourned.
Your birthday.